Imagine looking at a traditional architectural blueprint.
Right, with the perfectly straight lines.
Yeah, exactly. You've got these sharp, clean lines, perfect right angles, these like highly predictable boxes. And modern society really loves the blueprint.
Oh, we love it.
Everything has a designated measurable place, and everything is visible. And I mean, if you fit into one of those boxes, it's an incredibly comforting way to live, right? Because it's so orderly.
It's entirely built on categorization. You know, we love to measure things. We like those right angles because they give us the illusion of total control over our environment.
Right. But think about what happens when you step out of that perfectly measured building and you look down at a forest floor. You look at a root system or a beautifully complex, tangled weave of vines.
It looks utterly chaotic.
Completely chaotic compared to the blueprint.
Right.
But fundamentally, it's infinitely more resilient. Like a single snapped line ruins the blueprint, but the root system, it just routes around the damage and keeps growing.
Yeah, it adapts.
Exactly. And the tension between those two ideas, the rigid box and the tangled root, that is exactly what we are exploring today.
And honestly, it is the defining tension of our time. The research we're digging into today argues that this isn't just a philosophical debate, it's actually a matter of biological and communal survival.
Yeah, that's why we're so excited to have you with us for this deep dive. If you've ever felt like you're suffocating inside those perfectly drawn right angles, the materials we are unpacking today offer a literal, living blueprint for an alternative way to exist.
They really do.
We're pulling from this incredible stack of decolonial research, some really vivid visual essays, and lived experience frameworks. Our mission today is to figure out how we actually transition away from a rigid, isolating society and move towards something the researchers call access intimacy and neurodiverse love.
Gesturing towards regenerating collective accountability, really.
Right, building interpersonal connection, community healing. Ultimately, we are looking at sharing and improvising our way forward in a neurodiverse garden, supporting a shared ecosphere.
And this includes intersectional ABI survivors, right?
Yes, exactly. Diverse thinkers, including AuDHD ABI survivors and the global diaspora. The goal is to figure out how we may all flourish in our shared ecology.
And to be clear, you know, the scholars and advocates in this stack aren't just theorizing in some ivory tower.
No, not at all.
They're building a practical roadmap, and they focus heavily on those navigating what they call the glocal diaspora, which means communities that are globally interconnected through shared experiences, but deeply practically rooted in their local ecosystems. They're asking, how do we improvise our way forward in a world that fundamentally was not built for your neurological reality?
Exactly. But to build that new sanctuary, what they call the weave, we first have to understand the invisible cages we are all currently walking around in.
Right.
According to this framework, that dominant structure is called the grid.
The grid. And it's defined in these texts as a system of methodological individualism.
Which is a very dense academic term.
It is, yeah. The mechanism is actually quite simple. It means the system treats you, the self, as an isolated, standalone unit. You are completely severed from your environment, from your community, and your value as a human being is measured almost entirely by your economic productivity.
Wow.
You're a cog, essentially, and your worth is your output.
Which, I mean, makes sense if you're building a factory, but it completely breaks down when you apply it to human beings. Because existing on this grid creates something the researchers call a translation tax.
Yeah, the translation tax.
If you've ever walked into a doctor's office or like a workplace and realized you had to completely change how you speak or act just to be taken seriously, you have paid this tax.
Oh, absolutely. It is a massive, exhausting epistemic burden. The authors map out a specific matrix to show how this works too.
Right.
Essentially, marginalized people are constantly forced to translate their complex, nuanced, lived realities into the very inadequate, oversimplified language of the dominant society just to survive.
And the examples they give in the sources really struck me. They describe a queer refugee who might be fleeing incredibly complex, layered violence in their home country. But when they get to a border, the asylum authorities demand they perform a very normative, Western, linear coming out narrative. If their story doesn't fit the grid's approved storyline, they're just denied safety.
It's terrifying.
Or they talk about a trans patient who has to go to a clinic and perform a completely cis-approved script of bodily hatred just to jump through the hoops to get basic gender-affirming care.
And we see that exact same mechanism deployed against disabled individuals, too. The texts point out that to get basic human rights like housing assistance or healthcare, disabled folks are forced to advocate for themselves using the corporate language of economic productivity.
Which is wild.
It is. They essentially have to prove to a bureaucracy that keeping them alive is a good return on investment.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because reading through this, I kept thinking of it like a technology issue.
Oh, interesting. How so?
It's like you're being forced to run your brain on an operating system that was designed for completely different hardware. You're constantly running emulators just to make basic software work. Your processor is constantly overheating, and then society blames you when your battery completely drains by noon.
That is exactly the dynamic, and that battery drain is systemic. The researchers use a term for this. Hermeneutical injustice.
Hermeneutical injustice.
Yeah. Hermeneutical refers to interpretation or understanding. So this injustice happens when your lived experience literally cannot be communicated because the dominant society hasn't bothered to invent the vocabulary for it.
Wow.
Imagine experiencing a profound daily pain, but the dictionary in your country literally doesn't contain a word for it. The burden of proof and the exhausting labor of translating that pain into words the grid will accept always falls on the marginalized person.
And the research shows how this creates a brutal assimilation trap, right?
It does.
They specifically highlight this through the lens of neurodivergent folks in the Asian diaspora. For these individuals, assimilation is this impossible double-edged sword. To survive, they unconsciously mask their traits to fit the grid's model minority standard.
Right.
But that exact mechanism of survival becomes the very root of profound burnout, depression, and suffering.
And it's crucial to note here that this framework views the grid not just as annoying, but as a structure that actively suppresses authentic selfhood to maintain compliance.
It demands you flatten yourself to fit the blueprint.
Precisely.
So if the grid and this constant heavy translation tax are draining all of our energy, what actually restores it? Like, if the grid is the disease, what is the medicine?
Right.
So this brings us to a really beautiful restorative concept in the research called access intimacy.
Yes, access intimacy. The term was coined by disability justice advocate Mia Mingus, whose work anchors a lot of these visual essays we looked at. Mingus describes it as this elusive, almost eerie comfort that happens when someone else completely instinctively gets your access needs.
Eerie comfort. That is such a striking way to put it.
It really is.
It's that feeling when you walk into a room and you don't even have to ask someone to turn the fluorescent lights down.
Yeah.
Or you don't have to explain why you need to sit near the exit. It just happens.
Exactly. It happens without the exhausting labor of explanation. It completely waives the translation tax.
Wow.
Mingus describes it as a long, slow exhale, where the disabled body-mind can finally relax. It's a connection that starts from a place of what she calls steel vulnerability.
Let me push back on this for just a second, because I want to make sure I really understand the mechanism here.
Sure.
Isn't this just a fancy academic word for empathy, like just being an observant, empathetic friend?
What's fascinating here is that it is structurally entirely different from what we typically call empathy. The sources are very careful to define what access intimacy is not. It is not charity. It is not an obligatory, resentful helping where the person sighs and says, fine, I'll turn the lights down.
Right.
It's not a humiliating trade for survival, and it is absolutely not an ego boost for the person providing the access. The authors categorize all of those things under a different term, forced intimacy.
Forced intimacy, the daily expectation that you have to like crack open your chest and share your deepest medical trauma to a complete stranger just to get an accommodation.
Exactly. And access intimacy bypasses all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, in the neurodiversity space, there's a well-documented concept called the double empathy problem.
Oh, yeah.
The idea is that autistic and allistic or non-autistic people struggle to communicate, not because the autistic person lacks empathy, as the old medical model falsely claimed, but because their communication styles are operating on two fundamentally different frequencies.
That makes so much sense.
And access intimacy dissolves that problem entirely.
Yeah.
The room is tuned to a resonant, life-affirming frequency where you simply do not need to translate yourself.
You just get to exist.
Yeah.
But here's the catch, and the sources emphasize this heavily. You can't just mandate access intimacy. You can't put it in an HR handbook and expect it to work.
No, definitely not.
To truly achieve it, we have to fundamentally alter our operating system. We have to move away from Western individualism and tap into ancestral intelligence.
Yes. The decolonial research in our stack points us directly to indigenous Filipino concepts of the self to illustrate how this works in practice.
Right.
In Western thought, which is heavily influenced by philosophers like Descartes, the intellect is entirely split from the body and the emotion. You know, I think, therefore I am.
The individual is the center of the universe.
Exactly. But the Filipino framework rejects that split entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The researchers break this down into three interconnected concepts, and it completely changes how you view yourself.
It does.
The first is lube, which translates to the inner core. But it's not just your rational mind. It fuses the physical body, the emotional state, and the moral compass into one unified self.
It's a holistic view.
Yeah. It's a way of being that actively resists the colonial ledger, that tries to measure you strictly by how much you can produce.
But importantly, lube doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is encircled by the second concept, kapwa, which roughly translates to the shared identity.
The shared identity.
Right. Kapwa completely destroys the Western duality of I versus the other. It is the profound structural recognition that my well-being is inextricably tied to your well-being. I am because we are.
I am because we are. Huh. That is so expansive.
It is.
And you navigate that shared identity through the third concept, pakikiramdam, which is translated as knowing through feeling.
Just fascinating.
The text described this as a pivotal felt sensing. Like, have you ever walked into a room and instantly known that two people were just arguing without hearing a single word?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Pakikiramdam is that, but elevated. It's the ability to act as a living antenna for the energy of your environment, your shared ecology.
Yeah.
It's a highly evolved social intelligence that doesn't rely on rigid, linear words.
And this is where the research takes a brilliant turn, because it bridges this ancient spiritual intelligence directly with modern neurology.
Okay, wow.
The stakes of adopting kapwa are quite literally biological. The texts highlight extensive data showing that chronic social isolation, being trapped alone on the grid, physically alters the architecture of the brain.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Prolonged isolation actually shrinks gray matter volume in the temporal, frontal, and hippocampal regions.
It physically shrinks your brain. That is terrifying.
It accelerates cognitive decline and prevents healing. So when the researchers talk about regenerating collective accountability or using somatic anchors like deep breathing, rhythmic entrainment, or intentionally connecting to your kapwa, these aren't just poetic metaphors.
They're actual science.
They are biological countermeasures to the brain damage caused by modern isolation.
We literally have to move from being isolated nouns into being interconnected verbs.
Yeah.
But that raises a really tricky practical question, right? It's one thing to have a shared inner identity with your friends. But how do we organize a whole society around it?
That's the challenge.
Like, if we aren't using the grid's tools like police or punitive bosses or rigid rules, how does a community actually resolve a dispute without just falling into chaos?
That is the ultimate test of any framework. And the visual essays provide a fascinating synthesis to answer this. They look at the intersection of ancient Manobo relational governance from the Philippine archipelago, and they overlay it with the mechanics of 20th century diasporic jazz.
Jazz and tribal governance. It sounds like a wild pairing, but when you see the mechanisms side by side, it makes perfect sense.
It really does. Let's look at the Manobo customary law.
Yeah.
It is a system of decentralized authority that relies entirely on continuous consent, not coercion.
Right.
Power is not hoarded by a single executive. The community is led by the Datu and Bay, the chieftains and leaders, but they don't act alone. They are guided by the Manigaon, which is the Council of Elders.
And the texts highlight the three pillars of this leadership, which are all designed to sustain long-term collective health.
Mm-hmm.
First is relational mediation, meaning they de-escalate conflicts locally using that high emotional intelligence we just talked about.
Right.
Second is ecological management, which involves organizing lusong or communal labor to ensure everyone gets what they need from the harvest.
A shared effort.
Yeah. And third is agawate, creating shared spaces for singing, dancing, and transformative storytelling. It's about building the interpersonal connection before a crisis ever hits.
Now, overlay that ancient land-based reciprocity with the concept of diasporic jazz.
Okay.
The sources describe jazz not just as a music genre, but as an improvisational space for cross-racial resistance. It operates as communism of the senses.
A communism of the senses.
Yeah. Think about how a jazz ensemble works. You don't have a rigid conductor waving a baton telling everyone exactly what note to play.
Right. They're feeling it out.
By engaging in a shared creative act, the musicians are listening, adjusting, and making room for one another. They forge empathetic alliances that the grid cannot easily sever.
So let's put this into a real-world scenario. Let's say two neighbors have a serious dispute over resources. Instead of calling the authorities, using the punitive grid, and demanding compliance, you're essentially calling a community jam session.
Kind of, yeah.
You bring in the elders, and everyone has to find a rhythm together to heal the harm.
That is a perfect way to conceptualize it. And the sources map out exactly what this relational flowchart for de-escalating tension looks like in practice. It happens in three distinct steps, bypassing the carceral state entirely.
Step one, the solo. This is the foundation. Just like a jazz solo, all parties involved in the conflict are given uninterrupted space to articulate their reality. No one is shouting them down. It's deep listening.
Step two, the motif. This is the mediation phase. The influential peers and modern elders, the Manichaeans, step in.
But they don't issue a ruling like a judge.
Yeah.
Right?
No, not at all. They highlight shared themes from the solos. They use their social intelligence to cool hostilities and find the common melody without using any force or coercion.
And finally, step three, the harmony or temok. Instead of throwing someone in exile or getting the police involved, the community negotiates a restorative restitution.
Yes.
And I love this detail. This almost always culminates in a shared meal to physically, biologically solidify that rebuilt trust.
And what's crucial is that this relational governance doesn't just protect the people, it protects the local ecosystem.
Right.
The sources note that this framework defends Yutang Kabilin, which means treating the ancestral land itself as a living relative. It replaces the imperial model of resource extraction with localized sovereign stewardship. We are sharing and improvising our way forward in a neurodiverse garden.
Which brings us to the ultimate application of all this. Like, how do we take these massive decolonial frameworks and use them to support the most vulnerable folks in our shared ecosystem?
That's the real question.
The sources focus heavily on applying these exact tools to intersectional survivors of acquired brain injuries, ABIs, and diverse thinkers, including ADHD folks.
And the data presented on this specific intersection is truly staggering. The sources reveal hidden overlaps of trauma, noting that intimate partner violence, or IPV, survivors heavily overlap with brain injury.
This stat blew my mind.
The research shows that between 75% and 87% of IPV survivors sustain TBI's traumatic brain injuries from repeat impacts. Or they suffer from anoxia.
Wait, just to clarify the medical terms for a second. Anoxia, that's when the brain is completely deprived of oxygen, right? Like from strangulation.
Yes, exactly. A complete loss of oxygen, which causes massive, often unseen neurological damage. And yet, the text notes that this specific epidemic of brain injury remains largely invisible to the healthcare system.
It's invisible because of how the grid measures value. The sources bring up this concept of pretty privilege combined with gender bias. Doctors frequently look at a survivor who might be conventionally attractive or who has learned to heavily mask their symptoms to appear normal, and the doctor projects wellness onto them.
Right. They just assume they're fine.
Because they look fine on the outside, the medical system entirely misses the signs of moderate to severe cognitive impairment.
Which creates a devastating loop. It forces the survivor to consume their extremely limited spoons, their recovery energy on code switching.
Ugh. The translation tax again.
Exactly. They have to play the role of the ideal neoliberal subject just to navigate the medical bureaucracy. They are draining the exact biological energy their brain desperately needs for neuroplasticity and healing just to prove to the grid that they are worthy of help.
The sources also explore how our culture at large responds to this neurodivergence. And they introduce a really helpful tool called the Lexicon Quadrant.
Yes, the Lexicon Quadrant.
It basically tracks how the language we use either heals or harms.
Right. On the empowering community-led side of the quadrant, you have terms like ADHD.
Oh, I've heard that one.
Yeah, this is a functional identity label that beautifully describes the complex intersection of autism and ADHD. It's a term born from within the community to build access intimacy.
Right.
But on the exact opposite side, the erasure and insult quadrant, you have terms like acoustic.
Acoustic. I've seen this all over social media.
It's everywhere.
The researchers point out that this is weaponized algorithmic cloaking. It's a term used by internet trolls to bypass safety filters, turning a marginalized neurological reality into a slur replacement. It's a perfect example of how the grid continues to police and isolate neurodivergent body minds.
So the burning question is, how do we operationalize COPWA to fight this?
Right.
How do we actually change the PAIR model for brain injury survivors and neurodivergent adults? The sources are unequivocal. We have to transition away from guardianship and move toward supported decision making, or SDM.
Let's break that down, because the difference is profound. Guardianship is the grid solution. It assumes incompetence.
Complete incompetence.
It legally strips a person of their autonomy and enforces isolation by handing all control to one person. Supported decision-making, on the other hand, formalizes our natural interdependent networks. It leans into capua. It honors what the texts beautifully call the dignity of risk.
The dignity of risk. It's the absolute non-negotiable human right to make your own choices, to chart your own path, and yes, to occasionally experience failure.
To be allowed to fail.
Exactly. But under supported decision-making, you experience that failure within a supportive, loving community that helps you learn from it, rather than a system that locks you away for it.
It requires a profound shift in perspective. Like, we have to stop treating neurodivergent and disabled adults as defective individuals requiring unilateral control. The sources demand that we embrace a concept called disability gain.
Disability gain flips the entire medical model on its head. It argues that disabled and neuroqueer body minds aren't broken versions of a colonial standard. Instead, they carry incredibly unique resilience. They possess brilliant alternative ways of sensing the world. The insights gained from navigating a world not built for you are absolutely essential to our collective survival.
It's the tangled root system versus the rigid blueprint.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it all comes back to a core philosophy championed by Mia Mingus in these texts. The framework argues that our survival is not dependent on our ability to assimilate into the very systems that harmed us in the first place.
Wow.
It is deeply dependent on our ability to care for each other outside of them.
That is the true neurodiverse love gesturing toward a regenerative future.
Beautifully said.
So what does this all mean for you navigating your own life today? We've covered an incredible amount of ground.
A lot of ground.
We started by looking at the exhausting translation tax required just to exist as a marginalized person on the grid. We discovered the eerie, restrictive comfort of access intimacy. We learned to embrace capua, the profound truth that our identity is shared and that isolation physically harms our brains. And we explored how the blending of ancient tribal governance and jazz improvisation provides a literal, actionable blueprint for real community accountability and healing.
Ultimately, these sources are asking us to realize that rugged independence is a complete illusion.
A total illusion.
Every single one of us requires capua to navigate this world. Your well-being is my well-being. True freedom isn't found in isolation. It is deeply, inextricably bound up in the collective weave.
You can spend your whole life trying to force yourself into the rigid, right-angled boxes of that architectural blueprint. You can exhaust yourself masking your true nature to fit the grid, or you can look to the forest roots.
The decolonial frameworks we explore today assert that existence is a single, continuous, intertwined event. And that leaves us with a critical question to carry forward into your own life.
Let's hear it.
If your freedom is bound up in the collective, who are the informal elders, the manegone, in your own daily ecology, and how might you invite them into an improvised harmony the next time a conflict arises, rather than retreating back into the isolation of the grid?